I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, the fabulous Fox Theater.
Well, it's important in both practical and spiritual ways. It is the great symbol of Atlanta's heart and soul and conscience. And it's also a 4,500 seat in a garden of dreams that every major performer that ever plays a house of this size in the whole country, if not the world, is eager to come to.
It's a little over the top in some ways, and it's not something you would just do for any building, but very appropriate for a theater, a venue, a place to have special events, a place to go see a spectacle.
As elaborate as it is, and fanciful and fantastic, it is still practical. And it's an amazing balance.
It's funny, everybody, if you go to a downtown, everybody's been to the bank. Nobody wants to talk about the bank. Everybody's been to the historic post office. Who really cares? I mailed a package there. It's the theater where you had your first kiss. You met your husband. You know, you tasted popcorn for the first time. That's where that lives, and that's the authentic downtown.
There's a kind of two sides to it, I think. There's the architectural and physical significance of a building like the Fox. And there's the other side, which is the association with events and the meaning and the memory.
The movie is what might be what brings you in, but there's a whole nother experience of being in that theater and being with a community that's appreciating a film on that giant screen with that amazing ersatz Middle Eastern architecture.
You cannot believe how much old guard Atlanta had grown tired of looking at this old bizarre building, how they despaired over its dreadful condition, how they knew that its former owners had been losing money for a long time, and they were only skeptical about what we were trying to do. I remember Joe Myers was sitting at our lawyer was sitting at a dinner, and he was sitting next to this lady, and he started by Joe started laying on her how we ought to, he was trying to help save the Fox. And she says, "Why do you want to save that old dirty place? It's so tacky." But this is the way old guard Atlanta, even old guard Atlanta with good taste, looked at this place. Why was it designed in a handsome Georgian style? Why this Egyptian Moorish business? You know, I mean, you can't believe how tastes have changed, how Atlanta has developed.
My guests today are Beecham Carr, Executive Vice President at the Woodruff Arts Center and an integral player in the 1974 Save the Fox campaign.
In the final analysis, when it's made these great comebacks from the dead, it's been because the qualities of the building itself are so marvelous. And the public just has needed... people have need to be reawakened to this marvelousness from time to time.
Chairperson for Emory's Film and Media Studies, Matthew Bernstein.
I think the pleasure of the Fox that we can experience now is a reminder of that period, because there's nothing in the city like the Fox.
Leo Alvarez, urban design leader at Perkins & Will.
You know, an understanding of place has to begin with an understanding of the natural environment. Where you are, the climate, the kind of topography, trees, et cetera, natural systems. But you layer on to that all of the understanding of the cultural side and the social built environment, and you get a much more complete picture. So it's a complete added dimension that isn't always present.
And Molly Fortune, she's the director of restoration at the Fox Theater.
The two biggest phone calls I get a lot are, the stars are twinkling too fast. Does the weather outside affect what's going on in the sky? That is my job. My job is to make sure that every single leaf on that tree is perfect. So when you, as a patron, come in, see the forest.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Atlanta's fabulous Fox Theater. As we travel through this holiday season, exchanging gifts, and maybe now driving our way back to the mall to return them, we thought that for today's show, we would explore one of, if not the greatest Christmas gift the city of Atlanta has ever received, the fabulous Fox Theater.
It was a gift.
It opened Christmas Day 1929.
From both the Shriners and Fox, because it was originally built as a Shrine Mosque.
The ancient Arabic Order Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. The architect was an Atlanta firm called Marie Alger and Veneur, which did a number of buildings around Atlanta, but none of them nearly as significant as the Fox, like St. Luke's Episcopal Church and so forth. The Shrine Organization, which was a much sort of bigger portion of the world than it seems like today, and they were going to build this great temple. Well, their budget got really big, and the ideas got extremely grand.
And they realized they need a partner, basically, to keep the finances going in order to build this behemoth. And Fox rented.
William Fox, as in his company is now known as 20th Century Fox.
By 1917, movies are everywhere. Some have sound, some don't have sound. You start to get the building of the palaces because people want to escape. Well, he took advantage of this. And so he started to really roll with all the technologies that are required for these theaters. And he had the patents on speakers, on projectors, on lighting, just about anything you can imagine. But he was a shrewd businessman and opened palaces all across the United States. You know, some of the flagships were Detroit, St. Louis. A lot of people lump us in, not thinking that we were built by the Shriners, not his architect, Mr. Crane. And so when he found out that they were building this palace and they were basically going to let Atlanta use it as a civic center, he said, sign me up. And so he brought all this amazing technology with him.
From the 20s through the early 50s, when television came out, most Americans would see a movie a week. It's unbelievable how important movie houses were to the American public. It was their escape. It was their entertainment. It was inexpensive. It was also the only place you could go in the summer where it was cool because nobody had air conditioning at home. The Fox Theater was the first public building in Atlanta to have air conditioning. So that's why these enormous movie houses, movie palaces, were built all across the country. Atlanta had the Fox, and that was the biggest and the best, but we also had the Lowe's Grand Theater, which was originally the Erlanger, where Gone with the Wind premiered in 1939. We had the Howard Theater, which became the Paramount Movie House. We had the Roxy Theater, which stood where the Westin Peachtree Plaza Hotel is today. But all the others are demolished except the Fox.
The whole idea of building movie palaces, the movie industry had a problem as it was forming, which was that it was a very accessible medium. Anyone could attend the movies. And movies they caused great anxiety in American society, sort of like the internet today, particularly when you're thinking about children. So one of the goals of the pioneers of the film industry, many of whom got their start in exhibition, in running theaters. Louis B. Mayer ran a theater, a Nickelodeon in Boston, before he started making films. Almost all of the founders of the major studios began as exhibitors. Their problem was to try to lift the class association of movies beyond a theater for just anyone, and particularly in the Northeast for immigrants. Theaters, particularly Nickelodeons, the first form of dedicated movie theater were considered dangerous, dark, unhealthy. Untoward things can happen to unaccompanied women in these theaters. So the idea was always to try to give the movies more class. And what better way to do that than to build this incredible movie palace where people can pay an admission of 60 cents and for a couple of hours feel like they're in somebody's mansion. And you have an orchestra in the pit, you have sing-alongs, you have this full program. So there is actually an argument that, to a certain extent, movie going was so ingrained in people's weekly ritual, leisure ritual, that you would just go because of the theater. And that what was actually playing would be secondary.
Even the term movie palace is fittingly suggestive of how different the movie going experience was during Hollywood's heyday.
The standard run for a first-run movie in Atlanta in the 1930s was 1 week. In the classical era, the dominant Hollywood studios, there were five dominant Hollywood studios, Paramount, MGM, Lowe's, Fox, later 20th Century Fox, Warner Brothers, and RKO. What made these studios dominant was that not only did they have studios, and not only did they have national distribution exchanges around the country so they could send prints around at an operation of about $1 million a year, but they also owned the most profitable theaters, which were first-run theaters. They constituted about 16% of all the theaters in the country, but they collected up over 75% of the box office rentals. Because this, if when a film came out, and if you were a Clark Gable fan or a Bette Davis fan, the first place you would see these films would be at an affiliated theater like the Lowe's Grand. Movies were very inaccessible, and they built up demand. If you did not go to the Lowe's Grand to see Clark Gable in a film, you would have to wait because it would only play for a week, and then it would be withdrawn, and you could not see it anywhere in the city for about a month. This system, which was called run zone clearance, you have the first run in a certain zone, you then have a month's clearance, then you play in a lesser theater, less admission charge, and then you take it away again, and then maybe it'll play for 2 days, several weeks later. With declining ticket sales, declining accommodations, nothing was as nice as the movie palace like the Fox.
And Fox's kind of place in the market at that time was what?
Well, the status of the different studios constantly changed. Overall, because of the Great Depression, a number of companies went into receivership, depending on how many theaters they owned. Fox managed to do fine. It was not at the top of the list. It was not at the bottom of the list. But then it was in 1935 that Fox was merged with a company called 20th Century Pictures, which was created by Daryl Zanuck and became 20th Century Fox. So the fact that Fox was even open to this kind of merger with a relatively small independent production company indicates that it was not as strong as it could have been. Actually, William Fox, the creator of the Fox Studio, had conspired in 1929 to merge his studio with Lowe's MGM and create the largest studio. No one else would have been able to compete. He got into a devastating car accident, was unconscious for months. While he was unconscious, the Great Depression hit, the Wall Street crash, and by the time he came to and was functioning, they couldn't really pursue it. The antitrust division of the Department of Justice had decided this would be a monopoly and restraint of trade. Anyway, he had tried to build this tremendous empire, and he was thwarted, and he was out of the film business from then on.
Movies were movies when you paid a dime to escape, cheering the hero and hissing the man in the cape. Romance and action and thrills, partner, there's gold in them hills. Movies were movies when during the titles you'd know you'd get a happy ending, dozens of blundering cops in a thundering chase, getting a bang out of lemon meringue in the face, bandits attacking a train, one little tramp with a cane. Movies were movies when I ran the show.
With the rise of television came the steady decline of the importance of movies, and with it, the steady dilapidation of the Fox. This continued up until the 1970s, when the Fox was quite literally on the chopping block. The plans were to turn it into a Bell South parking deck. That is, until a grassroots coalition of young enthusiasts set out to save the Fox.
Movie audiences shrank precipitously after television, and the Fox was as much a victim of that as anybody. And so that by the late 1960s, early 1970s, they were showing just dreadful movies there, blaxploitation film. And the people who had the businesses that had owned the Fox since the 1930s were losing money. The building had fallen into pretty bad disrepair. At some point there, by the time our little nonprofit, Atlanta Landmarks Inc., got the good fortune of borrowing all the money it took and taking title of the building, you'd walk in the lobby and the Coca-Cola syrup that had been poured, that had been spilled under the carpet, was so thick that it would practically pull your loafers off. The seats had holes. Some of the furniture had been stolen by, and the management didn't care. It was just, a lot of the mechanical systems were in bad shape. So in, I guess it was 1975, the former owners sold an option on the building. to Southern Bell, which was then going to build its new corporate headquarters. That headquarters that they intended to build was in fact built on West Peachtree. It's a handsome building right behind us. We're looking at it out the window here. 675 West Peachtree. What it just looked like a bargain property to the vice president for real estate at Old Southern Bell. And that's the only place he was coming from. This is an inexpensive property. This building is worn out, tired, losing money. This makes sense. He didn't hate the building. He didn't want to hurt Atlanta. He just thought this was a bargain, so why not? There was a lot of protest from a grassroots level to save the Fox, and people would pay their phone bill and write on here, save the Fox, you know, this is a terrible thing. So when Southern Bell realized that they had sort of made a ghastly mistake, they started looking around for somebody to buy this, take this option off their hands. And none of the established interests in Atlanta, nobody who really was experienced at real estate, wanted to fool with it either. So we put together a little nonprofit organization, and we had just wonderful people, all sort of idealistic younger people with passion for this place, and said, okay, at Southern Bell, you can't find anybody to take this over. We'll take it over. And they said, okay, we will lend the Atlanta Landmarks, Inc. the money to buy this place on the condition that if you can't repay this mortgage in 3 years, each of you will sign a pledge saying you will no longer protest the demolition of the Fox Theater, and we'll get it back and we'll go ahead and tear it down. That seemed like a really onerous burden on one hand, but it was also a marvelous opportunity. They're making it tough for us on one hand, but they're also setting up a situation that helped a lot of holdouts understand, hey, this is something that's got to be done. So by late 1977, early 1978, it became almost everybody in town saw the wisdom of this. So that by the end, we had all the money we needed, actually a bit of surplus, and paid the mortgage off several months before it came due.
Was it with great ceremony, or was it just sending over a check?
A little of each. We had a closing, and everybody who was going to bring money to the table came down to, I can't remember if it was a law firm or a bank downtown, and presented their checks, and everybody showed up on time, and we paid off that mortgage, and the Alston firm, Joe Myers, canceled all kinds of debt instruments and so forth. It was just a great triumph. And then we had, on Easter Sunday, 1978, just a week or two after we paid off the mortgage, put an ad in the paper thanking Atlanta, and said we're going to have an open house on Easter Sunday, and that anybody could come and do tours in the theater for free, and we'd have a little show. Well, our little show was a wonderful old pipe organist who was actually a WSB radio television named Bob Van Camp. He would play the organ. So the whole, 4,000 people come into the theater, and so the whole house was packed, and at 2 o'clock promptly, Bob Van Camp pushes the button, and that fabulous organ console, which is about the size of a Mack truck, comes pulling up out of the organ pit and the orchestra pit with the lights on it, playing Irving Berlin's Easter Parade. It was a magical moment, and the whole crowd just gasped and applauded. He did that. He played that performance two or three times that afternoon for full houses, and we were just thanking Atlanta because the support had been overwhelming.
I'll be all in clover, and when they look you over, I'll be the proudest fella in the Easter parade on the Avenue, Fifth Avenue. The photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure. I could write a sonnet about your Easter bonnet and of the girl I'm taking to the Easter parade. Thank you.
In the same way as a city can never be said to be finished, a building like the Fox is never truly saved because it constantly needs to be restored.
Most people don't know that all of our furniture is original or all the lighting fixtures are original. We're missing only 3 pieces out of our historic furniture collection. So you have that automatic ambiance. It's an atmospheric theater. You want to be transported someplace. And that place happens to be an Arabian marketplace. And you are sitting between 2 beautiful walls. Some people say they're castles, but they're beautiful crenellated walls that have turrets in it and are, as we say, scored to look as if they're limestone walls. And they've got beautiful texture. And you could be very mistaken into thinking that they were. And in this, you are sitting under a beautiful striped canopy that protrudes out from the back, so it protects you from some of the elements. But peeking out are 96 stars, 82 twinkle. And you've got clouds that are just going over as the darkness starts to come in. And the performance is underneath the arch of a bridge. And you can see the lights of the bridge as if people were going to walk across on their way to the market or going back home. And they've thrown their rugs over to air out or to sell their wares. And you just happen to be able to see the performance going on under that bridge that they can't see. Everything is artistically done. It's not just your average blue house paint. It's an ultramarine theatrical blue that radiates from the blue lights in the turrets. And the stars are a big light bulb that shines through a crystal that gives it a kind of an iridescent feel. It's all theater. I mean, seriously, it's not just what's on the stage. It's pierced that fourth wall, if you will, between the actors and the patrons. You are part of the performance now, and it's all theatrical.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio, brought to you by Perkins & Will. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Atlanta's fabulous Fox Theater.
So you have a historic building that is maintained in a 1929 fashion, is a national landmark, is on the National Register of Historic Places, a working museum, to the number one theater in the world for its size.
To really understand the significance of the Fox and its place in the city of Atlanta is to see it as not just a landmark, but as an opportunity. Yes, it is one of the oldest and most distinctive of Atlanta's buildings. But now it sits at one of Atlanta's most central intersections and can serve as the vanguard to Atlanta's cultural awakening.
In terms of its role in Midtown proper and in city life and the kind of urban experience of Atlanta, it's unique. It has architectural character and uniqueness. It has history associated with it and all of the events and the memories that come with that that people have experienced at the Fox. Those are the things, I believe, that give a city in the long term a certain degree of authenticity and depth that it takes centuries and millennia to accrue, in a way. And, you know, so many of our cities, like Atlanta, have been built in a relatively short period of time as compared to European cities and other places in the world. And so we don't have that history to sort of that we've been caring for and has become part of the fabric. We've been changing so fast that in many ways the historic fabric can't establish itself for long enough, and so it kind of heightens the importance of preserving the fabric that we do have, the buildings like the Fox, which the Fox is probably the best example that we have in Atlanta of that. We always use places like Savannah or places like New York City, Manhattan, as an example that the same city block that holds the Empire State Building can hold townhouses, brownstones. So it's designed in a way to accept a very vast, diverse array of uses and conditions that will, in fact, change. Every single piece of built fabric that we have is an opportunity for something interesting, something great, something that, you know, captures someone's imagination. That makes the whole thing hold together. And again, the Fox is one of those. It's a unique piece. You wouldn't necessarily build, you know, a whole street of buildings like the Fox. It wants to be unique, breaks the pattern of the city and the grid, but it's the appropriate way to do it. It makes a special moment for a special use. And it's that synergy that place like the Fox creates for the surrounding area that's also so important, above and beyond even its beauty and memories and so on, is, you know, all the restaurants and all the activities that go that supports it, and it gets people into town. That diversity of activities that they have, events within the Fox, then spills out to permeate that portion of the city, even if it is just for a night. And that's all part of that experience that only a real city can give you. And so that's, to me, the kind of best legacy of it, is that it provides that synergy, it provides an anchor, it provides connection to the other places around, and creates a magnet for that vibrancy.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Beecham Carr, Matthew Bernstein, Leo Alvarez, and Molly Fortune. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Happy holidays, and we'll see y'all next year.